establishing all of the important elements. We're trying to understand the Chinese experience of life, which is seminal and very important to us because we are becoming Chinese in our thought forms, and the 21st century will be heavily influenced by Chinese thought forms. It may not be predominant, but it will be considerable, at least the equal of all of European thought put together, which is considerable. So we're trying to establish for ourselves a sensitivity and an ideational comportment at the same time. Taoism is the basic tradition in China, just as the Hermetic tradition is the basic tradition in the West. It's difficult for us to perhaps bring in the full scope, but let's review for just a moment. About 3000 BC, about the time that the Great Pyramids were being established in the old dynasty in Egypt, the first civilized cultures were being established in north-central China. And at this time, there was no dynastic chronology. And the earliest cultural hero, mythological hero, named Fu Shi, was a dragon man. And he is sometimes portrayed as wearing animal skins, a leopard skin, of having very long fingernails, very long distinguished mustache, Chinese style, very long hair, and quite often dragon-like in his posture. And he is reputed to have been the originator of Chinese civilization. That is to say, what distinguished the Chinese people initially from any other people was a symbolic system based upon what were called in Chinese the Ba Gua, the eight trigrams. And these trigrams translated arcane symbolic natural phenomenon into intelligible symbols which could be used together in the same horizon of mind that the symbols which appeared in nature were somehow a parallel, a correspondence. That wind and mountains and sun and lake, all of these qualities are in the same horizon in nature. They belong to nature. Different people would have different experiences or different images of these natural phenomena, and so man was fragmented, whereas nature was whole. With Fu Shi's eight trigrams, a mental horizon of consistency was made for the very first time in Chinese civilization, which meant that someone 500 years later would have the same symbolic understanding and comportment, could have the same mind, so that the civilization could be transmitted and built. It could accrue, it could have accumulated penetration, so that it extended beyond the caprice of an individual life or the oral tradition of three or four generations. It established an unbroken lineage, a continuity, which became the Chinese civilization or the Chinese mind, as we might say. After about 2,000 years of building on the basis of Fu Shi's legendary eight trigrams, the complications, the extenuations of that insight had managed to generate what we know today as the I Ching, the Book of Changes. And the Book of Changes, around 1000 BC, underwent a metamorphosis. That is to say, the symbolic system that had been used for 2,000 years, which based itself upon nature, so that man's mind was a correspondence to nature, changed. And it was no longer so much that man's mind was corresponding now to nature, but that man's mind in itself was a nature. And this was such a momentous change that it brought down the first really established Chinese dynastic rule, the Shang, and instituted the second Chinese dynasty, the Zhou, C-H-O-U, about 1000 BC. The Zhou characterized themselves as bright, new, young people who understood for the first time, in humane terms, we would say, humanistic terms, the cosmic power which human beings have. That they have not only the ability to correspond to nature, but man's nature in itself is cosmic. And so the attention of Chinese experience after that went towards the development of man. But there was still a holdover of taking one's cue from nature, that the development of oneself surely could be in terms of the symbolic civilization, but one could always return back to nature. But in doing so, one had to take oneself out of the civilization. In the latter stages of the Zhou dynasty, some 500 years down the line, there was a bifurcation, a split, as has been characteristic of Chinese experience in life. The split polarized around two seminal individuals, Confucius on the one hand and Lao Tzu on the other, polarized the Chinese experience. Confucius said, we can always find ourselves by remembering the past of man's civilization. And Lao Tzu said, there are times when man's civilization is absolutely out of kilter with cosmic principles, and therefore man has to return back to primal nature. It does no good to remember anything about human culture. So that Taoism and Confucianism, around 500 AD, split the Chinese character. They were still Chinese, they were still interrelated, but there was a definite parting of the ways. The Confucian order founded itself upon the ability of man to regenerate himself to a position of power and control. And as the Zhou dynasty waned in power, the Confucian ideal was more or less kept on the back burner. But when a new dynasty was formulated, when a superhero who the man who built the Great Wall of China, when he re-established the Chinese Empire, he gave the Chinese people his name. His name was Qin, and so they became known as Chinese. And he reinstituted his power on the basis that this was a regathering of energies of man, and that the Confucian ideal was to be the backbone of this regathering, and that where the Zhou dynasty had gone wrong, the new dynasty now would be able to maintain itself indefinitely, because the basis of the human cosmos was that man had to train himself, that he did not have the capacity, just left to his own nature anymore, to achieve wholesomeness, if I can use that term, as a human being. That people had become so separated from nature that they now needed the culture to mature. And so the new dynasty that was set up, the Han dynasty, instituted the civil service exams based on the Confucian classics. so that China became Confucian for the first time in the Han, so that the Chinese experience, like the Roman Empire, was the first time that the Confucian world order came in, and human culture was seen as something which could be reconstituted from time to time by the use of comprehension. But the emphasis there, subtly, was that man had to disengage himself from the individualistic temperament of just being out in nature by himself. We can have a dynasty if we all do it together. But anybody who doesn't work with us has got to be excluded, because the whole principle of our reconstitution is that we're all working with the same mind. And when we have our mentality in order together, then we can progress. One can see that the seeds of totalitarianism are here in this kind of thought. In fact, the Taoist tradition, understanding that the Shang dynasty had fallen, that the Zhou dynasty had fallen, that even a mythological dynasty before the Shang, the Xia, had fallen, and seeing that the Han dynasty was doomed as soon as it ran out of powerful individuals, talented individuals. And so Taoism took a tack that the individual had to be developed in terms of taking him out of human society, out of the Confucian classics, into natural experience. And when the Han dynasty ran into problems, tremendous revolutions around the first century AD, around, say, 10 AD, somewhere around in there, it was a signal for the Taoists that their view was correct. And even though the Han dynasty was reinstated for another 200 years, Taoism grew in those 200 years, questing for a position in nature. During this time, there were three orders of Taoism that they considered a part of their tradition. First, there was Fuxi and the Book of Changes, and the Yellow Emperor, Huang Ti. All of this belonged to a mythological past, as we would say today. We would call that a mythological level. In Chinese landscape painting, those are the mistiest tall peaks in the background. Then there was a median ground of still very large cliffs, very large mountains, but closer in, with vegetation that one could see, trees and so forth. And this was the classical Laozi in his Tao Te Ching. And then closest in, much more close to human proportion, say like large boulders or like the forest path or the little hut that one would have among the trees, would be Chuangzi. So that you had a tertiary background. You had Chuangzi real close in that gave the details for a personable existence in Taoist experience. Then you had Laozi, which was the landscape context for the forest and the hut and the path. And then in the background you had the ranges disappearing majestically into infinity. And in this context, the individual could always take himself alone. He needed nothing else. He needed no preparation, no permission, no support, no confreres, and no competition. He just went. And so the Chinese experience of Taoism, after the fall of the Han in the 3rd century AD, blossomed in this sense of individuals trying to work out their own formula. And we had for about 300 years in China, the 3rd, 4th, and 5th centuries, 6th centuries AD, a rash of utopias set up by individuals, a rash of recluses, and for the first time we have talented individuals who have been thoroughly accomplished in life, in official life, taking themselves and retiring at an early age. And we saw one of them as the first great Chinese landscape poet, Tao Yunming, who died about 427 AD. And we saw in the poems of Tao Yunming a reverberation of Chuangzi in a way. So the Chinese Taoist tradition begins then to build a man-centered, a literary, artistic-centered expression in consciousness of what had been the Taoist experience in what we would call the BC centuries. And after Tao Yunming, in about three centuries, we have the Great Tang Dynasty. And these Taoists, these poets, these philosophers, as we would say, are like the complement of Lao Tzu. And then in the Sung, we will have the great landscape artists, which are like the complement of the Yellow Emperor in Fuxi. So that by the time that the Mongols, the Jin Tartars, take over all of China around 1279 AD, Chinese civilization has gone almost full circle again in the Taoist tradition. And the last great indigenous expression of Chinese Taoism will be the great landscape paintings of the Southern Sung. And we'll get to that in just a little bit. The Mongol experience in China was to try and take away from the Chinese this hegemony of mind which they had developed for thousands of years. And so pursuant to that, the Mongols invited in every single religious experience. Manichaeans, Zoroastrians, Muslims, Nestorian Christians, everyone was welcome. And especially under Kublai Khan, grandson of Genghis Khan. And we have the testimony of Marco Polo, who was there in Cathay at that time. China was excellently run on the surface by an uncontested military power. And Yuan thought sought to widen the spectrum of Chinese thought so much so that Chinese traditional thought, Taoism and Confucianism and so forth, were just elements, trace elements, in a new mix. But the Jin Tartars were naive because the Chinese Taoist tradition was superior to any of these religions that were brought in. And the reason for it is that Taoism had already had a run-in with a major world religion, Buddhism. And from the 3rd century AD through the 7th century AD, the Taoist masters, in their own traditional way, found a way to take Buddhism and turn it inside out so that it became Chinese Taoism. And in the towards the end of the Yuan Dynasty, we'll see, in the founding of the Ming Dynasty, will be on the basis of the Chinese having learned to do this with every other religion, every other phase of thought. But the Chinese Taoist tradition allowed them an insight, a structural insight, into world religions, which other world religions did not have a capacity to defend themselves against. And the Taoist tradition slowly turned them inside out and made them Taoist. The same thing is happening in the late 20th century to scientific thought. The religion of Western scientific thought is now being sinified, as they say, if I can use that as a pun. The reason that Taoism is able to do this, has always been able to do this, is because its structure is in fact an obverse structure to all of the other forms of human intelligence. It works with the intervaling rather than the notes. And everyone knows that if you change the interval, you have a different song, even though you have the same notes. And the Chinese do not care what notes there are, as long as they set the pace. And the Tao, the great Tao, is setting the pace. And that's all it's concerned with. And whatever you want to hum is your business, as long as the pacing is Chinese. Then not only are you in harmony with the ages, but you're in harmony, period. So we're looking at a very strange experience which is relevant to ourselves in the most arcane, massive way possible. Let's look at Lao Tzu for just a moment. Let's take an excerpt from him. Let's see what, at this level, Taoism talks about, how it's presented. I'm going to use Richard Wilhelm's translation of the Tao Te Ching. This is section 77 of the Tao Te Ching. This is 500 BC. This is classical Taoism, but a sort of a middle ground now. The Tao of heaven, how it resembles the archer. He presses down what is high and raises that which is low. Whatever has too much, he reduces. Whatever does not have enough, he completes. It is the Tao of heaven to reduce what has too much and to complete what does not have enough. Man's Tao is not so. He reduces what does not have enough in order to offer it to what has too much. But who is capable of offering to the world that of which he has too much? Only he who has Tao. So there's two Taos. The Tao of heaven works by balance. Man's Tao is to work by imbalance. But when he understands this, he can harmonize his tendency towards imbalance with the greater Tao. How? By making a principle of his asymmetry. And the principle of his asymmetry is to allow for the recompense, the reaction of his asymmetrical movement to occur along with him. Thus, writes Lao Tzu, thus also is the man of calling. He works and does not keep. When the work is done, he does not tarry with it. He does not desire to show off his importance to others. So it's a message here, familiar somewhat to readers of the Bhagavad Gita. Work, but do not become attached to the fruits of action. So that the asymmetry comes in precisely to not holding on to what you develop, but continuing to develop whatever it is that you do. All right. Chuangzi, which is the close-in ground. Notice the difference right away here in Chuangzi, about 300 years later. Once Chuangzi dreamt he was a butterfly. A butterfly flitting and fluttering around, happy with himself and doing as he pleased. He didn't know he was Chuangzi. Suddenly, he woke up, and there he was, solid and unmistakably Chuangzi. But then he didn't know if he was Chuangzi, who had dreamed that he was a butterfly, or perhaps now a butterfly dreaming that he is now Chuangzi. Between Chuangzi and the butterfly, there should be some distinction. This is called the transformation of things. Now, to a Taoist, it doesn't matter at all, one way or the other, that the transformation between one and the other is the key. That the transformation is possible because what makes it possible is that that barrier which would forbid it is able to be lowered. And what is that barrier? Man's mind deciding one way or the other. The basis upon which he would decide one way or the other is a mind based on identity and difference, that somehow Chuang Tzu and the butterfly are different. But the asymmetrical mind of Taoism, interested in the intervaling and not the notes, doesn't give a fig whether you're a butterfly dreaming you're you or you're you dreaming you're a butterfly. The transformation is sound in any case, and so be happy. This is Taoism, and it's a totally different experience of thought. In fact, when we come to the Sung Dynasty, as we are tonight, as we are here, the Sung Dynasty divides itself into two parts, the Northern and the Southern Sung, and their geographical areas as well as temporal areas. When the Tang Dynasty, which had reinstated Chinese power again, had brought the old Han sovereignty back, had brought the idea of a great dynasty back into China, and then the Tang underwent the crucial crisis of consciousness, which the other dynasties had, and it too declined and fell apart, and it seemed impossible that anyone could put China back together. But somehow, the masterful Sung Chinese around 960 AD established another dynasty, the fifth or sixth or seventh along the way. But they found themselves impoverished constantly, even though they were wealthy and powerful, because they were constantly fighting across an enormous frontier. The Tang Dynasty had pushed the Chinese frontier as far as the Caspian Sea. And to try and defend this long border against all of the barbarian peoples from Korea to Iran was prohibitively expensive. And so the Sung pulled an ungracious coup in Chinese history. They decided to let the Jin Tartars have northern China, and they withdrew to southern China. They withdrew below the Huai River, which is between the Yellow River, the Huangho Yellow River, and the Yangtze River. The Huai River is about midway in between them. In 1127, the Sung aristocratic upper class and ruling dynastic populations withdrew and moved their whole capital from Kaifeng in the north of China down to Hangzhou in the south of China. And they paid off the Tartars in silver and silk every year, horrendous amounts, seemingly. But it became apparent after a while that whereas the Sung Dynasty, which had controlled all of China before, had been spending some 50 to 60% of its gross national product on defense, the Southern Sung was now spending only about 1% of its gross national product on defense. Plus, they were having to have no standing armies. And so the Southern Sung found themselves extraordinarily prosperous, and the population of China ballooned in the southern part. And it was a great age of aesthetic and literary experiment, of philosophic discourse. And for about 150 years, southern China, the Southern Sung, grew very prosperous, happy, and fat, until finally the descendants of the Jin Tartars under Genghis Khan couldn't stand the fact that there was anybody they hadn't conquered, and so they conquered them anyway. After they received the tribute, they sent the hordes in anyway, because Genghis Khan wanted to rule the world, and it didn't matter to him what the conditions were. Everyone was going to be in his kingdom. But in this difference between the Northern Sung and the Southern Sung is a monumental difference in the Chinese experience of Taoism. In the Northern Song, Taoism in the Taoist tradition expresses itself in Chinese painting in a Chinese way that we can almost see the classical beginnings of Taoism. We can almost see Fu Xi and the Yellow Emperor. Almost these mythological proportions come back, almost as if the most powerful archetype in the collective Chinese consciousness comes up into expression. Then in the Southern Song, there's a slight change, seemingly slight, but it becomes ever more important. The Northern Song is called a monumental landscape style, whereas the Southern Song is called the lyrical landscape style. In the Northern Song, we will see that the landscapes are arcane and cosmic, and man has the smallest incidental part in the composition. He's admitted to the composition simply because he is a part of it. But in the Southern Song, even though the landscapes still have man as a small part visually, the style of the painting shows that the artist is important. That it isn't the cosmos that's important, but it's the artist. And the Southern Song artists, those painters, become fantastic individuals. And they become like the Taoist recluses and hermits, only instead of being off by themselves, they are expressing themselves in terms of painting and sometimes in terms of poetry. I have, before the slides, I want to give you two examples from Chinese poetry, one a Northern Song poet and one a Southern Song poet, so you can see in translation from literature somewhat what I'm talking about, this difference. The Northern Song poet, the greatest poet of the Northern Song, is Su Teng Po. Here's a characteristic poem of his. The clear wind, what is it? Something to be loved, not to be named. Moving like a prince wherever it goes. The grass and trees whisper its praise. This outing of ours never had a purpose. Let the lone boat swing about as it will. In the middle of the current, lying face up, I greet the breeze that happens along and lift a cup to offer to the vastness. How pleasant that we have no thought for each other. Coming back through two river valleys, clouds and water shine in the night. That's Su Teng Po of the Northern Song. And now here is the Lu Yu of the Southern Song. Mist-veiled plants in the little garden reach to the house next door. Mulberry trees make deep shade. One small path slanting through. I lie down to read Tao Yunming's poems. Less than one chapter when the fine rain brings an excuse to jump up and hoe the melons. So you can see what a difference there is between the Northern and the Southern Song. The Taoist tradition is active in both of them, but the expression in the Northern Song is for a monumental cosmic scale, while in the Southern Song it's the lyrical personal scale that comes in. Later on, when Chinese thought tries to regather itself in the Ming Dynasty, which will be the last great Chinese dynasty, there's been no great dynasty since the Ming. The Ming Dynasty will try to bring the lyric and monumental, the individual and the cosmos, back together. And the task of Chinese civilization in the Ming will be to reintegrate these two strands of the Taoist tradition together. And we'll see that the Ming largely is unsuccessful in this, and in fact yields to the destiny that China suffered. The Ming dynasty fell to the Manchu charters again. And that would bring us up to the 20th century when the Republic of China was established after the Qing dynasty fell. And in a very real way, the whole arcane motion of the People's Republic of China has been to reestablish what the Ming dynasty failed to reestablish: the lyrical possibilities of the individual with the cosmic scale of the real. And later this year, we'll get to it when we get to the Taoist tradition in the late 20th century, we'll see that one of the great Taoist masters in the 20th century was Zhou Enlai, who used Mao Zedong as a foil to establish the reintegration of the lyrical individual with the grand strategy of the cosmic real. And if somebody would have talked this way 20 years ago, the first word in everybody's mouth would have been Sha, with a PS. But the fact is that within two or three years of Mao Zedong's death, Zhou Enlai had full control, and his heirs run China today very comfortably. And one, if one is naive about Chinese history, about the viability of the Taoist tradition, wonders how did this happen? That from a billion people waving the little red book, that all of a sudden there are no little red books anywhere in China. In just one decade, how does this happen? The reason is that in understanding the Chinese mind, don't look at the notes. They absolutely don't count. But the intervaling is ever so important, and there is a grand strategy to this intervaling, and one can understand this. In the Sung, the Chinese experience, when they moved their capital down to Hangzhou, they found that luxury does not work. We have, for instance, in Marco Polo's travels, we have a description of Hangzhou in its heyday. He calls it in here Kinsai. Hangzhou is called by the Mongols Kinsai. And here's a little bit of Marco Polo's description. This is in the Penguin Classics translation, page 213. It goes on for about 15 pages. Just give you a paragraph or two. So he receives the splendid... reaches the splendid city of Kinsai, whose name means City of Heaven. It well merits a description because it is without doubt the finest and most splendid city in the world. Hangzhou, at this time, simply dwarfed in grandeur and size anything in Italy or anywhere in the world. I will follow the account of it sent in writing by the queen of the realm to Bayan, the conqueror of the province, when he was besieging it. This was for him to pass on to the great Khan, so that, learning of its magnificence, he might not let it be sacked or laid waste. I will recount the contents of her letter in due order, and it is all true, as I, Marco Polo, saw later with my own eyes. He did, in fact, go to Hangzhou. He was sent on many missions by Kublai Khan. Marco Polo was quite an individual. And Kublai Khan was a great appreciator of human capacity. And when he found that Marco Polo was not only honest and courageous, but willing to adventure, he gave him assignments. He gave him whole fleets of ships to go as far as Indonesia and secure trade routes. And Marco Polo always kept good accounts and reported back to the Khan and kept everything in order, and that's why they finally let him go. First then, it was stated that the city of Kinsai is about 100 miles in circumference. because its streets and watercourses are wide and spacious. Then there are marketplaces which, because of the multitudes that throng them, must be very large and spacious. The layout of the city is as follows. On one side is a lake of fresh water, very clear, and it was an enormous lake, about 30 miles across. On the other is a huge river, which, entering by many channels, diffused throughout the city, carries away all its filth and then flows on into the lake, from which it flows out towards the ocean. The ocean is about 25 miles from Hangzhou. This makes the air very wholesome, and through every part of the city it is possible to travel either by land or by these streams. The streets and the watercourses alike are very wide, so that carts and boats can readily pass along them, carrying provisions for the inhabitants. There are said to be 12,000 bridges in Hangzhou, mostly of stone, though some are of wood. And those over the main channels and the chief thoroughfares are built with such lofty arches and so well designed that big ships with tall masts can pass under them, and yet over them pass carts and horses. And so well are the street levels adjusted to the height. Under the other bridges, smaller craft can pass, and no one need be surprised that there are so many bridges, for the whole city lies in water and surrounded by water, so that the many bridges are needed to let the people go all over town. And then he goes on.
What year was that, Roger?
Marco Polo's about 1300 or so, around 1300. In fact, in his description, the luxury of Hangzhou dwarfs anything that he had ever seen. The Millionaire's Row in Hangzhou was bigger than the Gin Tartar capital. All along the shores of the West Lake that was there were huge estates with enormous villas. And there were docks out into the water with huge boathouses. And there were soirees every night along this entire coast of about 25, 30 miles on a side. And then in the hills just behind the lakefront estates were other villas and estates up in the hills. And these were like vacation retreats and so forth. And then higher up in the mountains, behind them, were also individual retreats and so forth. So the Hangzhou was a huge complex of pleasure, sophistication, and urbanity. The Chinese had had great cities like Chang'an and Luoyang before this, but Hangzhou in the Sung was a massive city. If you can imagine, it's